Teton Village. I lived in Jackson Hole for a summer, and the manager who hired me was cool and passionate about the job. The chef and the kitchen staff were all kayakers and fishermen. They were relaxed but serious about their work. After a few weeks, they decided to trust me and give me the job of expediter, which meant that I made sure all the meals got out to the right tables on time. If I screwed up, it screwed everything up. I liked and respected these guys, and I dared not let them down, so I took the position very seriously. They gave me a hard time because I was a little college boy, but I eventually earned their respect. At least I think I did, since they let me smoke a joint with them at the end of each shift. During that summer, I burned my arm so many times carrying so many piping hot steak plates into the dining room, to the point that I became calloused and impervious to the pain. I guess you could call that another on-the-job life skill for my resume. I healed quickly, though. My hands basically look like they've been soaking in ivory since I was born. Manual labor is not my strong suit. Surf instructor. Sort of. This was my first job out of college. Working for a fun 40-something-year-old guy in Charleston who had a small real estate business. The problem was is that he was going through a divorce and had three kids, ages 11, 10, and 8. Right when I got hired, his ex-wife got engaged to another man, and my boss got custody of the kids the week after I started working for him. Essentially, I was his fourth kid. He had no time to run a business since he was Mr. Mom all of a sudden. I loved it, though. I wasn't making much money, but he'd call me on my way into work and say, "Change of plans, you're taking my son surfing today." Hell yeah, this is my dream job. Those kids were great, and my first rather unproductive job out of college was a true success, except financially, I guess. Side note, instead of gaining the freshman 15 during college, I gained weight after I graduated. On the way to my job, I would grab a blueberry muffin and a cherry Coke for breakfast, then a bowl of chili turkey sandwich and fries for lunch, and then for a sensible dinner, I'd have a six-pack of beer. I knew I was getting chubby when the buttons on my pants started to fly across the room every time I sat down, thus becoming dangerous projectiles. Secret shopper. After several years of fruitless post-college professional pursuits in Charleston, my dad insisted I get my shit together and get a real job. One with a boss who asked me to do something besides take his kids surfing. I didn't want to disappoint my dad, so I got a job down in West Palm Beach with a home-building giant, Pulte Homes. I didn't hate it. It was corporate and a bit stifling at times. There was also some really cool guys in the upper positions, and they enjoyed my water cooler stories about babes and beers. My job was to be a secret shopper and go around finding out how competitors were doing in our market and around Florida. I was on the road a lot, and it was like I was a pizza delivery boy all over again, mixed with a secret agent. There were two schools of thought about how to do this job. One was just to go in, say you work for a competitor, and ask how they were doing. The problem was you never knew how honest they'd be. Plus, it wasn't all that fun. The second school of thought was more my style. Pretend like you're a buyer, even though I was 24 years old and I look 18. Make up a story about who you are and try to do some math in your head and figure out how quickly the community is selling homes and what type of homes, essentially so we can copy what they're doing. Or if it's not performing well, learn from their mistakes. Creating a secret identity was my favorite part of the job, although I wasn't always great at it. Once I got lazy, and when the competitor salesperson approached me, I said, "I'm looking for my parents." What I meant was that I was looking for a home for my parents, but I guess I really did look young because totally deadpan, they replied, "Where's the last time you saw them?" All I could do in that moment was admit I was a spy. The job had other perks, like giving me the chance to meet women in faraway places. One time in Naples, Florida, I had dinner at the bar of an Outback steakhouse. The bartender was hot, and every douche sitting near me was drooling. I made a few offhand funny comments and left my number on the bottom of my check and wrote, "Call me." Wouldn't you know it, she called. I told her to bring a case of beer to the Ramada Inn where I was staying, and oh, what a night we had. At the end of my tenure as a secret agent, I sort of screwed up, though. I went to a conference in Orlando and was just dead tired from the Ramada experience. Thank you, Outback. No rules, just right indeed. I couldn't keep my eyes open, so I nodded off a few times at the conference and got put on double secret probation by a woman who I'm pretty sure didn't like me and my carefree attitude, Even though the older guys at the company thought I was hilarious, she had a job to do, I guess. So I sheepishly accepted the punishment, whatever the fuck double secret probation meant. Market analyst. Eventually, I knew I had to leave the Pulte job. It was boring, and I was starting to treat it as such. For example, my falling asleep in conferences. Plus, I was in my mid-20s, and all the new guys coming into the office taking all the cool positions had gone to grad school and were telling me that in a big corporate environment like this, you couldn't get anywhere without a business degree. I had been living in my grandparents' house in Florida. They were only there 2 months out of the year. And one day, they told me that the famous golfer Greg Norman was speaking at their country club and asked if I wanted to join them. I was a huge fan of his, so I said, sure. There I was listening to his life story, and I especially took interest in all the business success he had achieved. Then and there, I devised a plan. I was going to ask Greg Norman if I could get a job with his organization, Medalist Developments. I told my grandparents that I would meet them at home, and I waited in line to say hello to Mr. Norman. He was very nice, and I manned up and asked him for a job. He passed me off to his business partner, Bart, and I was off to the races, sort of. It took about 4 months of clandestine back-and-forth communication, so no one at my Pulte job would find out, but I finally got the job. I can't tell you how good it feels to work behind the scenes and lock down another gig when you aren't living your current one. But I'd be remiss if I didn't mention part of the reason I got my new job with Medalist Developments. When I interviewed with the president of the company, I'll call him Edward, he asked me where I was from. I said I was from South Carolina, and so was he. Then he said, wait a minute, is your mom Frances Hobbs? I told him that was her maiden name. And then Edward said he went out on a date with my mom when they were in college in Chapel Hill. No fucking way. Needless to say, the interview went well. When I got to the parking lot after the interview, I immediately called my mom and asked her about Edward. She said, I remember Edward. He got arrested during our date for jumping on a cop car and we had to bail him out of jail. At that moment, I thought, hot damn, this job's for me. I worked in market analysis and land acquisitions for 2 years at Medalist. It was an Australian company and I met some great Aussies. I swear I'm part Australian. I was loving life, but eventually I decided it was time to heed the advice of my older friends at Pulte and start thinking about business school. Chapter 3, Losing It. I was a precocious and tempestuous young whippersnapper, and I've had my fair share of adventures when it comes to working or not working. But there's a major force that helped to shape me into the man I am today that I haven't spoken about yet. And that force is called puberty. Or, as some would say, one's formative years. Many of my formative years were spent at boarding school until I was kicked out my senior year 5 months before I graduated. As I write this book, I'm on an email chain with some of my former classmates who are planning a reunion, and it's taking every bit of self-control I possess, which isn't a ton, not to hit reply all and write, fuck you. My classmates didn't have the final power to kick me out, but some of them shoved me toward the door. It all worked out in the end, but at the time it felt apocalyptic. I guess it still does, since I still feel the urge to email profanities to them in all caps. Restraint hasn't always been my strong suit. So how did a model citizen like myself wind up at boarding school? It's not for the reasons you may think. My older sister is and was the smartest person in our family. She had her nose in a book her entire childhood. I remember being gobsmacked that she didn't like spending the night at friends' houses when we were kids because she would rather be at home reading. Are you kidding me? For me, spending the night out with friends felt like a giant safari into the unknown. The only true pitfall being whenever I wound up at a house where the mom was healthy and had an awful snack cabinet. When saltine crackers and ice water are the highlights, you know you're in trouble. I'm proud to say that the snack cupboard at the Rose residence was robust and bountiful. Shark bite fruit snacks, Gushers, Oreos, Girl Scout cookies, we had it all. Rounding out the bounty, my mom made and still makes the best grilled cheese on the planet. Her secret is Velveeta singles. In the morning, the sweet, sweet morning, she'd make all-you-can-eat chocolate chip pancakes. We had kids lined up around the block to be granted the rights of a Rose sleepover. So maybe it isn't so weird that my sister didn't want to leave our house. But I digress. As I said, my sister was extremely smart, and my mom decided that she needed to leave Hilton Head to seek a top-notch education at a boarding school up north somewhere. My sister and my mom visited the mall. Deerfield, Hotchkiss, Choate, Exeter, you get the idea. They ended up liking a school in Northern Virginia called Episcopal High School the most, a beautiful and historic school outside of Washington, D.C. The school had just become co-ed, and one could argue Northern Virginia is Southern. I guess it depends on which side of the Mason-Dixon line you're standing on. It was beautiful, rolling green hills, old brick buildings, just like in the movies. All the students were boarders, even if they lived nearby, and most of the faculty lived on campus, literally down the hall from us. What could go wrong? My sister was unsurprisingly doing very well there, so when it came time for me to go off to school and broaden my horizons, I just followed her lead. Even though I might seem pissed about getting kicked out of the school, I'm not bitter, not 100%, at least. I forged some lifelong relationships there, and the education I received was second to none and highly competitive. We read and studied Chaucer and Shakespeare, and we even delved into Tom Stoppard's Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, which is a somewhat satirical and cool play about two minor characters from Hamlet, similar to Samuel Beckett's Waiting for Godot, which we also read. It was around this time that literature became interesting and fun to me. Before boarding school, there was always a boring list of books that everyone had to read over the summer or in class. And it was mostly Steinbeck's The Pearl, Hemingway's The Old Man and the Sea, which won him the Pulitzer Prize, but I think is one of his most boring works, and the all-time worst book in the history of civilization, Stephen Crane's The Red Badge of Courage. My mom and I almost killed each other every summer because of these required books, because I never wanted to sit long enough to read a stream of consciousness book about the Civil War or some stupid pearl. I wanted to play sports or shoot alligators with BB guns. That all changed in boarding school. Somehow, I was suddenly happy to trade in the BB guns for time spent sitting in a classroom breaking down characters and themes in Shakespeare's plays. It was like a light bulb going off in my brain. My love of literature also eventually helped me get girls, but I'll get to that later. During this time, I especially loved Polonius' advice to his son Laertes in Hamlet, before Laertes heads off to school. Not all of Polonius' advice was golden, but this one is a gem. Be thou familiar, but by no means vulgar. Those friends thou hast and their adoption tried, grapple them unto thy soul with hoops of steel. But do not dull thy palm with entertainment of each new hatched, unfledged comrade. Not that I astutely followed much of this advice, but it just made me nostalgic for all the well-intentioned guidance I got from loved ones before I left for school. I've always loved the saying, do as I say and not as I do. There are some really useful nuggets in the quote. Polonius talks about not being gaudy and flashy, lessons I learned from generations of my family that I wholeheartedly agree with. Also, don't borrow or lend money, a lesson we all must learn over time, especially when friendships are involved. And perhaps the most famous line of advice in literary history, to thine own self be true. Never try to be someone you're not. I love digging into these famous texts and discovering that Shakespeare had invented stories and themes that writers have been mimicking in one way or another for hundreds of years. Kind of like this book if it were written in iambic pentameter. My favorite play of all was Henry IV Part 1 and 2. No surprise, this is where a precocious and fun-loving Prince Hal parties and carries on with a group of fun-loving ne'er-do-wells. I guess you can say I aspired to be him. In part two, he has to make a decision about whether to grow up and take the reins from his father as king, ditching his rapscallion friends, led by his mentor, the prodigious partier and joie de vie proponent Falstaff. God, I love Falstaff and all the promises of a good time that he embodied. Of course, Hal, who I also loved, makes the difficult and mature decision to leave his degenerate friends behind, a decision that I would not and have not made. But let's face it, I have considerably less at stake. It's not like wars will break out if I don't change my ways. Hal had a raw deal in that sense. I would compare some of my boarding school friendships to the closeness that World War II soldiers felt when they were trapped behind enemy lines with danger around every corner. Most of the faculty was like the secret police, and I'm only exaggerating a little here. Whenever we were away for the weekend, after filling out the proper permission slips and forms, the dean of students would go into full detective mode and put the pieces of the puzzle together so he could bust us for drinking beers at a friend's house who lived nearby. It was a constant game of cat and mouse, and it was so unnecessary. Didn't the dean have a life? Why did he care what we did on our off time? Did he think he was responsible for the lives of minors or something? Okay, fine, on that score, I guess he was. What made the faculty most like the secret police was that the bust never ended with one person getting in trouble. It was always an interrogation, like, we know it's not your fault, but whose fault is it? Who is with you? We'll lighten your punishment if you cooperate. We were teenagers getting treated like FBI informants, with promises of clemency. The honor code at the school said you must not cheat, but if you discover someone cheating and you don't turn them in, you yourself are breaking the honor code. If you've seen Dead Poets Society with Robin Williams, it was exactly like that, rules-wise and aesthetically. Rolling hills, lush forests, and humorless administrators who were definitely not in on the joke. In my school, it felt like there were spies everywhere, and just my luck, I landed in the class with the most spies. I will eventually get to the actual reason I was kicked out, but you need to hear my full side of the story to understand that I was completely innocent, or marginally innocent. I often wonder, why couldn't I have landed in my sister's class, which was full of hilarious and irreverent students who were always having fun and being slightly subversive? I basically learned everything I know and became the man I am today by hanging out with the older kids. We'd eat acid and smoke dope in the dorm and just laugh the night away, while the kids in my class were probably peeking around corners, taking notes on our whereabouts, and trying to bug our room so they could play the tape for the dean. We learned a lot about ourselves mentally in those days. In addition to my love of literature, boarding school also awakened my lust, and I owe one of my first semi-sexual experiences to a local girl who was somewhat of a legend, nicknamed Snake Boots. One night, the older guy said they had a rite of passage for me, or as some would say, they wanted to haze me. The plan was to get me drunk and sneak Snake Boots into the dorm. I suspect her name came from the fact that she would allegedly undertake an arduous journey scaling the campus fence and crossing frozen tundra to get to our dorm. And she wore boots to do it. Who knows? In any case, they told me she loved to indoctrinate young men who needed a little extra shove to get to legendary status. Translation, I was a skinny, awkward virgin, and they told me Snake Boots could help rid me of that blight. I wish I could say I had some luck with Snake Boots, but I'd be lying. And I promise you, dear reader, that everything in this book is true. I was the perfect candidate, though, goofy and slightly pathetic with a tinge of potential. I was definitely a late bloomer. At that time, I thought of girls as this magnificent and mysterious meta-species, almost like a deity. I was never quite sure why they would ever be interested in guys. I've always loved the Seinfeld quote from Elaine. The female body is a work of art. The male body is utilitarian. It's for getting around. It's like a Jeep. I agree. If I could only go back in time knowing what I know now, that girls are just as insecure and awkward as we were back then. I was never smooth. I was tall, grossly skinny, bird-chested. I was basically the captain of the weird body team. And sadly, my run-in with Snake Boots didn't cure me. Alas, I woke up the next afternoon, and everyone in the dorm was laughing that I had blown it with Snake Boots. My life at that moment felt like a 1980s teen comedy, and I was the butt of the joke. Snake Boots tried to have her way with me, but because I had zero alcohol tolerance, I was skinny and bird-chested, remember? I just passed out cold. I wasn't even mad, though. I feel proud to have been part of such a calamitous adventure, and maybe even a little happy that I later ended up losing my virginity card to someone I actually loved, or liked a lot, or liked loved. Anyway, let's call her Jenny, and she was great. Before Jenny, I was definitely in no man's land romantically. I remember friends making out with girls in seventh grade on the playground during varsity basketball games, and I was uninterested and couldn't believe they wanted to miss the game for a girl. I was addicted to basketball and surfing, and everything else took a back seat. My first kiss was in eighth grade with a girl, let's call her Tina, who went to the public school on Hilton Head. And it happened right after I went surfing at night with some friends. It was a full moon, and I remember being sort of scared I was going to get eaten by a shark because I heard they feed at night. I came in from the water, and there were girls on the beach, and Tina and I went to this bench on a golf course overlooking a pond, and we kissed. She definitely made the first move. But since everyone else I knew was already making out, I got off the sidelines and into the game. We shared a big, old, sloppy French kiss that I later described to my best friend as being akin to standing in a waterfall. That's how wet and sloppy it was. But damn it, I had done it. I was off the bench and driving to the hoop. It was good to get it out of the way, but I can't say I was eager to spend the evening swapping buckets of spit with a girl after that kiss. I just wanted to surf and shoot hoops. Tina had other ideas, though. She started to write our names together in all sorts of artful and creative ways on her school binder. Apparently, she was already planning our wedding. This sort of irrational exuberance forced me to emotionally withdraw from her. My binder was full of drawings of athletes like Michael Jordan and Kelly Slater. I didn't have room left to draw Tina's name, literally or emotionally. I took a sabbatical from the crazy little thing called love for a while. I let my friends do the exploring, and then they dutifully reported back to me. I didn't give them any competition whatsoever. You're welcome, guys. Then, in the blink of an eye, everything changed. One fateful day in the ninth grade, I saw two girls playfully wrestling in the lounge area at school, and I got all warm and fuzzy, and that was it for me. Suddenly, basketball and surfing took a back seat. You may notice the rather large gap from this moment until I actually lost my V-card senior year of high school. Let me again remind you of the awkward years. I looked like Sesame Street's Big Bird, with a chest so skinny it looked inverted. I liked girls, I wanted them, but I couldn't fathom how or why they'd like me. I was just a goofy and hyper little teenager with no moves whatsoever. It also didn't help that I always liked popular older girls, since they were just absolutely unattainable. I remember there was one girl who I'd call on the phone and I would have a script all written out with questions I'd ask plus possible answers from her, which would lead to a series of follow-up questions depending upon her answer. It was like a choose-your-own-adventure book. In boarding school, I eventually grew out of the awkward phase, and by senior year I had filled out a little, probably from having the munchies 24/7. I'd been a sailing instructor at Commander Zodiac, best job ever, had a nice tan and long hair tucked behind my ears. I was improving. I had the confidence to maybe think girls might actually be interested in me. After all, my friends and I were suddenly the cool seniors of the school, and we had all the weed, we knew where to score beers, and we organized the parties. And so, of course, the girls were into that. Plus, I was the singer in a Grateful Dead cover band, so that didn't hurt. I did a scorching rendition of China Cat Sunflower straight into I Know You Rider that people still talk about in the halls today. If by the halls you're talking about my house in Charleston, and by people you mean me. Jenny was a sophomore when I was a senior, and on the dating front I outdid myself convincing her to be my girlfriend and then eventually take my virginity. To this day I'm amazed when guys say they lost their virginity at 14 or 15 years old. At that age, I would have fainted if a girl took her clothes off in front of me. By the time I met Jenny, though, I'd gotten over my fear of fainting and was ready to redeem myself after my snake boots incident. Jenny was great, and her parents approved of me because she told them how much I love books and how great my vocabulary was, so my love of literature came in pretty handy. I remember exactly where we were the first time we had sex, and I remember the conversation right before it and the conversation 20 seconds later when it was over. The worst part of being kicked out of boarding school, other than the disappointment of my parents, was that I had to leave Jenny, my first love and girlfriend. I was super sad to leave, and we continued to see each other throughout the summer. But let's face it, the college-bound senior and the girl back at high school combo rarely works. If you don't believe me, just watch the movie Can't Buy Me Love. I'm still friendly with Jenny and think the world of her. In fact, I ran into her last summer in North Carolina mountains at a barbecue restaurant, and we hadn't seen each other in ages. We got to catch up for a little bit, and it made me smile to see that she looked great and seemed to be doing well. She had just camped out in the Appalachians for a few days, so I'm pretty sure we were not destined to be together. Despite the fact that I like going to my family's farm and hunt and fish, I'm an indoorsman. I can handle maybe one night in a tent with no showers, down pillows, or plumbing, but several, hell no. If there are huge trout to be caught or waves to be ridden, there are lodges for that, with good food and wine and beds. Sorry, Jenny, we were not meant to be. The people who dropped the guillotine on me were some of my classmates on the discipline committee. Like I said, we had to have had the nerdiest class in the history of the school. They were like six cool people and the rest were just go-getters and Dudley Do-Rights. You know the type. Self-righteous overachievers who are to be avoided at all costs because they do not get the joke. They were probably organizing Run for the Cure for Acne charity races on the weekends. My friends and I were the ones in the woods smoking and doing the important work of discovering new hookup spots around campus. Those hookup spots were a valuable commodity because every night after study hall, the boys and girls would get together and if you were seeing someone, you'd grab each other and scour the campus for a private place to clumsily make out. Like I said, important work. Among our discoveries were the gazebo, a popular destination, the squash courts for pros only, the science lab, and the dark room for film development and makeout sessions. I also once experienced hookup nirvana when I broke into the gym and used the high jump mat. What a revelation. Basically, my friends and I were the wild Delta Tau Chi frat in the movie Animal House, and everyone else was the nerdy button-up fraternity and sorority. I was actually kicked out due to an accumulation of offenses, small things that just added up, like drinking, smoking pot, bending rules, enjoying life, basically. So to sum up, I got kicked out and had to leave Jenny behind because I had too much fun at boarding school. My poor parents. This is a recurring theme in my life, so sorry, Mom, again. As a proud boarding school non-graduate, I say that if any parent or administrator is thinking of touting boarding school, I'd think again. You take a bunch of hormonal kids from all over the country and mix them together, and then tell them not to break the 10,000 rules that you set. Meanwhile, back at home, all your friends just got their first car, they're throwing beer bashes and having actual bedrooms to get busy in. I was kicked out mostly for just trying to get away with doing the things my friends back home did all the time, only they didn't have self-appointed police watching their every move. Even though it sucked in the moment, once again, the magic of Shep Land took hold, and I was able to finish high school back at home, so it all worked out. I didn't know it at the time, but being kicked out of boarding school would eventually help me land at a college where there were plenty of girls, as opposed to a college in the mountains with approximately 2 girls. Here's what happened. Based on my good grades and SAT scores, yes, you heard that right, I had gotten an early acceptance to SWANEE, the University of the South, in the mountains of Tennessee. It's a cool little liberal arts college, but it's most definitely a small pond. I was pretty excited to go there at first. It was college, after all, and you could drink beer without being hunted down and tortured or kicked out. That said, I did foresee a bit of a problem. It was a small town in the mountains with just 1,500 students, so to me it sounded a little like the sequel to boarding school. When I was kicked out of boarding school, SWANEE said that they would no longer be honoring their early admittance, making the tail between my legs journey back to Hilton Head even more arduous and fraught with peril. My dad was pretty upset, understandably. But you know what? The experience was also a testament to how lucky I am to have such great parents. They actually felt bad for me. Yes, they voiced their disappointment, but they also knew how badly I was hurting and how devastated I was. I was 17 years old, and this was a pivotal point in my life, emotionally and otherwise. They made sure that I was going to right the ship and get through this rough patch, and it really did and does mean the world to me that they cared so much. So once I got back home, the game plan was to get a college advisor and figure out what my next move was. It was March of my senior year, so pretty late in the game college admissions-wise, and we had to move quickly. I volunteered at the Boys and Girls Club of Hilton Head Island, mainly hanging out with the kids and playing basketball. I once dunked on a 10-year-old kid and became a minor celebrity in their eyes for about 4 minutes. My dunk heard around the southeast got me only so far. After that, I was furiously applying to schools, and I got some interest from the University of Georgia. After all, I did have a decent resume and test scores, so if you just turned a blind eye to the whole kicked out of school thing, I looked like a pretty good candidate. I got in, and the rest is history. I wound up in Athens, the greatest college town in America, with a huge football program and as many lovely girls as one straight dude could ever hope to be surrounded by. Eureka. I'm fairly certain I would have burned all meaningful sexual bridges at SWANEE in less than a year. Now I was a medium-sized fish in a very big pond. I had plenty of room to eat, grow, swim, and misbehave. Note to Craig, new pillow alert. So here we go again. Back to Forrest Gump's mom and her speech about destiny. Does everything happen for a reason? Was getting kicked out of boarding school the best thing for me? Or am I fairly adroit, with a loving support of my family, at turning lemons into lemonade? I would like to say that if anyone at Episcopal High School Endowment Office is reading this, please stop asking me for financial contributions. Yes, I can't believe they still want a check for me. While I appreciate the chutzpah and fondly remember a handful of professors, and I am forever grateful for being introduced to Tom Stoppard's work, please consider this chapter an official unsubscribe from your donation list. Ask one of the Dudley Do-Rights from my class. I'm sure they'd rather spend their money on your fine institution than on beer and surf trips to Tahiti, unlike me. So there you have it. I lost my virginity at boarding school, me, a late bloomer with a bird chest. I'd almost argue that not much changed in my 20s and 30s, except instead of a bird chest, there's a little beer belly to contend with. I'm still captain of the Weird Body team. To be honest, I've never once thought of myself as an attractive dude. I don't use hair products or dress nice, except for when I have to, like the occasional wedding or event. All I've ever wanted was to laugh and make others laugh. It sounds cliche and like a self-help declaration, but I swear it's true. I never really had moves, but I have donned a neck brace and done fake falls in front of a bunch of hot girls to get their attention. It worked. Despite what some might think, I don't consider myself all that smooth. I have never been a whisper sweet little nothings kind of guy. As noncommittal and flippant as I might be, I take pride in the fact that I do not make promises I can't keep to get laid. I don't promise the moon and the stars while my eyes wandering to another girl across the room. And a big fuck off to those who do. I've always maintained that I just like to have fun, and a big part of having fun is being with girls. Turns out that the Cyndi Lauper song, Girls Just Want to Have Fun, is true. Although my favorites are Time After Time and True Colors. If you show a girl a good time, whether it be on a boat, at a ball game, playing beer pong, or fake tripping while wearing a neck brace, if you make them laugh, you will get girls. It's not that complicated. You also absolutely, positively have to have a sense of humor about yourself. That is a must. Create a fun, light environment, and you're in like Flynn. Another important rule when it comes to women is to never act aggressive. Act like a gentleman, as much as you can after 12 beers. Stay relaxed, don't try too hard, and maybe just steal a kiss here and there. I had a friend who took a really beautiful girl out 4 times and they had a blast, but he never tried anything. After the 4th date, she attacked him and they had sex in his car. I love that. Anticipation can be maddening and intoxicating. Being a lot of fun mixed with being respectful is a winning combination. If you aren't that gregarious, you can be the silent brooding type in the corner. It's a role I'm incapable of playing, except for once, by accident. I was with my friends, partying hard, and we took a flight on Singapore Air from Thailand to Bali to surf. On the flight, I was fresh out of serotonin, joyless and brooding. The flight attendants were all hot, so my friends were chatting them up, but I was all out of charm. The next night we ran into the flight attendants at a pool party, and one of them told my buddy that she liked me on the plane because I seemed dark and disturbed. Me, dark and disturbed. The Emperor of Shepland? My friends almost passed out laughing. The bewildered girls asked why that was so funny, and my friends pointed over at me. And there I was in the pool with a local babe on my shoulders, engaged in an epic game of chicken fight with another couple. Her dreams of the brooding guy in the corner were shattered. I have some good insight about getting girls, but once you get the girl, I still haven't figured this out. I'll paraphrase the Outkast song, Hey Ya, to get my point across more poetically. Know what they say is, nothing lasts forever. I've thought about this often. Why monogamy and relationships don't work, at least for me so far. Very few species mate for life. Penguins, beavers, wolves, gibbons. And they may mate for life, but they don't get married, for obvious reasons, but still. Marriage was a concept created when the average life expectancy was like 25 years old, in order to ensure that two people procreated and took care of children so they could grow up and propagate the species. What about lust, though? That's a powerful emotion. Should we bury it forever once we're in a relationship? Yes, you can lust after a spouse, but come on. The weird thing is my parents have been married for close to 50 years, and there's been almost no divorce in my extended family. I have all the good solid relationship examples one could seek, but for some reason I just get pessimistic when it comes to marriage and commitment. Or is it just realistic? When it comes to relationships, I guess I'm still a late bloomer. And maybe that's my Forrest Gump destiny. All I know is that if I had married a girlfriend years ago and had kids and a normal job, you wouldn't be reading this. You'd probably be slogging through The Brothers Karamazov by Dostoevsky or something equally dense instead. So, you know. You're welcome. Chapter 4. The Tooth Hurts. This chapter is going to be full of painful memories, or memories of physical pain. Either way, it will change your life, or entertain you, or make you squirm. Here goes. Let's start with the facts. I have had stitches in my head alone over 10 times. In case you're reading this drunk and you're confused, that's not 10 stitches in my head one time. That's many stitches in various parts of my head 10 different times. And in case you're sober and doubting me, I consulted with my personal historian, aka my mom, and she confirmed the numbers. And by her account, 10 might actually be a conservative number, so let's just go with 10. I've also broken both feet and hands several times. I've had teeth knocked out on multiple occasions, as you will see. But why, you might wonder, am I telling you about all my physical injuries as if I'm a decorated soldier or MMA champ? A couple of reasons. A. I figure I'm lucky to be alive, 100 times over, and that realization has informed my decision-making as I've grown older. My injuries have given me a seize-the-day attitude, which leads me to taking chances and doing things that more conservative people with fewer stitches in their personal history might scoff at. B. I'm starting to think that today's kids are completely coddled and overprotected, to their detriment. Assessing risk and personal limits is essential. Throwing caution to the wind is also sometimes important, even if it's only to help you realize you don't have the stomach or pain threshold for it. So maybe this will inspire parents to loosen the reins a little. Your kids don't have to have 10 head wounds to live a happy life, but a stitch here and there, let them live a little. Despite what it sounds like, I wasn't even the wildest SOB on the block. There were a handful of other kids who would engage in extremely risky and psychotic behavior, like doing backflips into the pool from the roof, stealing bikes, or water skiing in gator-infested lagoons while being pulled from a moving car on the shore. I confess I did burn ants with a magnifying glass once. Sorry, PETA. Maybe I fell out of trees, but other kids shot BB guns at each other. Actually, I also did this. Often. Still, my buddies and I knew, somewhere in the back of our adolescent minds, that we had a lot to lose and that torching bridges or ants and accruing a dangerous reputation was not going to be good for business long term. There were plenty of kids I grew up with who didn't mind truly breaking the rules, and some of them wound up robbing banks and selling drugs. One guy I knew wound up working as a cable guy by day and he sold drugs at night, that is, before he got caught. I was right on the cusp of following in those footsteps, but I never veered over to the dark side for very long, mostly because of my parents. Because of them, I knew what the stakes were if I screwed up, and they taught us right from wrong from an early age. I was more like an instigator or catalyst for wild and potentially dangerous ideas, kind of like Woody Woodpecker. Mild insanity and chaos followed in my wake. I definitely didn't play it safe, but I was often rescued or I happened to fall on the right side of the cliff. Whether that was due to blind luck, fate, or me in the back of my mind knowing that to besmirch my mother and father's name would be devastating, I can't say for sure. But I was a capricious youth, which in turn led to some trouble, often ending with those damn stitches. The strangest thing is that over time, all of my wildness and my injuries made me a somewhat cautious person. I came to realize how many times I'd barely skated through potentially fatal or crippling disasters, and that realization changed me. You won't find me riding a motorcycle or hella skiing. I surf, but not when the waves are over a certain size. I feel like I've tempted fate way too many times, so I quit being reckless. If I ever have a child, I'll tell them there are a lot of ways to get attention or make someone laugh, and putting yourself in danger of physical harm is definitely a popular one. But please consider the consequences. The end of life as you know it. I would also add, there is no better way to get attention or affection than by using your wit. Don't be Evel Knievel. Be the court jester hilariously describing the dangerous jump over the Grand Canyon instead. That's my parenting advice. Be funny and don't get injured. But back to my injuries. Let's start with the open wounds. The first was when my sister pulled me off the kitchen counter when I was a toddler. I still have the scar under my chin. I got her back a few years later when I pulled the gutter off the roof and it landed on her head, giving her 8 stitches over her eye. There was also the BMX bike ramp into our family pool that I'm lucky didn't kill us all. I did a backflip off the ramp, hit my head on the bricks on the side of the pool, and you guessed it, stitches. Then there was the time I was skateboarding in the neighborhood and tried something stupid, like attempting a trick I wasn't remotely qualified to try, and bam, more stitches. After this skateboard incident, the doctors in the hospital put me in a secluded room because they saw how long my injury rap sheet was, and they figured I might be a victim of child abuse. Turns out it was the other way around. Again, sorry, Mom. Two of my best stitches stories, though, involve love and the Old West. Let's start with the Old West. I was a junior in college in Georgia, and I planned a debaucherous manifest destiny road trip to Jackson Hole, Wyoming, with two of my best friends, Andrew and Jim. For some reason, we decided to drive across the country in two cars for three people, which shows you how solid our decision-making was at that time. Andrew's car was nicknamed the Gravedigger, another warning sign. It was a ridiculous monster truck-type vehicle with huge wheels and a crappy engine, despite several attempts to rebuild that engine. I was in the other car with Jim, which was a hand-me-down for my mom nicknamed the Blueberry because of its blue exterior and blue leather interior. I inherited this car at 15 because my parents are the king and queen of hand-me-down cars. We drive them until the wheels fall off, and I'm very proud of this fact. Keeping up with the Joneses and having fancy cars was always scoffed at by my parents. In any case, I drove the Blueberry and we spent 12 days driving across the country, a trip that usually takes 3 days, FYI. I wish I could blame the Gravedigger's sketchy engine for our lengthy travel time, but really it was because we decided it would be a good use of our time to stop in cities that had the best classic rock stations. Kansas City hooked us with Radar Love by Golden Earring. St. Louis played A Mean Little Wing by Stevie Ray Vaughan, a killer Hendrix instrumental cover. You get the idea. So we stopped at those places and spent the night and tried to find a good time. This was before TripAdvisor and Yelp, so we usually failed in our quest and ended up at a terrible bar on the outskirts of some suburb, drinking shots and getting into arguments about who Jim was going to ride with the next day, me or Andrew. Call us a ship of fools or maybe a gang that couldn't shoot straight? The Three Stooges? How about the Keystone Cops? All of these descriptions were applicable. We ended up stopping in Cheyenne, Wyoming, when we easily could have pushed through to Jackson Hole. Cheyenne just had an air of Old West nostalgia, and we wanted to see some real cowboys. I think we actually thought there'd be tumbleweeds rolling down the street. We finally made it to Jackson Hole and checked into a hotel, sharing a double room with a rollaway bed. Then we got absolutely rip-roaring drunk to celebrate the end of our journey. This was right around the time that the movie Fight Club had come out, to give you some context. We get back to the room and decide to beat each other up, Fight Club style. None of us are fighters at all, but there we were, merrily punching each other. Suddenly, Andrew and I looked at each other and decided Jim deserves a beating. He's been like the pretty girl at the dance this whole trip, and we've had enough kissing his ass just so we can have someone to talk to in the car. So we jump him and start wailing on him. He managed to squirm out of our clutches, and he grabs a luggage rack and hits me squarely between the eyes, blood everywhere. You may be horrified, but we thought it was highly entertaining at the time. Luckily, the hospital was across the street from our shitty motel, and Jim and Andrew gingerly escorted me to the emergency room to get stitched up. The doctor asked what happened, and we told him that we were jumped by a bunch of cowboys. We launched into a wild story that involved a girl, some whiskey, and assless chaps. The medical staff asked if they should call the cops, and we demurred and said that we were probably asking for the beating. They naively let my friend stay in the room while I got stitched up, but after hearing Andrew and Jim keep saying, "You missed a spot," the doctors kicked them out. I suffered 10 stitches between my eyes, but I have never laughed so hard under such duress and pain, and I have the Old West to thank for that. Now let's delve into the love portion of my top stitches of all time. Everyone has a personal injury list like this, right? No? Just me? I had just moved to Charleston after college and started working for Exit Realty. I was really into this girl, Molly. She had gone to college with some of my friends in Virginia, and so we knew of each other. The problem was that she was sort of seeing someone else, so I was trying to figure out how to proceed. One weekend, a group of us were out on Folly Beach and I was surfing, which I guess can be a bit of an aphrodisiac. Actually, it definitely is. Just Google surfer's wives. I headed back to the beach and asked if Molly wanted to learn. Next thing I knew, we were frolicking in the waves and laughing. This didn't seem like a bad precursor to a clandestine courtship. After our surf session, a week passed. I was out surfing again trying to show off to no one in particular, and I did a backflip off my board, landing on my head on a rock jetty. I started to see stars and bleed, so I limped in and got a ride to the hospital, receiving 7 stitches in my head. I had immediately called Molly and told her about the accident, making sure to embellish my athleticism and bravery. Then I politely asked if she'd pick me up from the hospital when I got my stitches out in a week's time, and she agreed. So the following week, I get to the hospital and tell the nurses that there is a girl I really like who is picking me up, and that I wanted to make her laugh. The nurses got excited and asked what I needed to accomplish my goal. I told them that my head had to be mummified, as in the whole thing wrapped in gauze, except for my 2 eye holes. I also needed a neck brace, and I needed the nurses to roll me out in a wheelchair for good measure. They were amazingly cool and obliged me, rolling me out to see Molly when the time came. After I mumbled her name as if I had head trauma, to her horror, I ripped off the gauze, jumped out of the chair, and carried her in my arms to a beautiful surf and turf dinner with fine red wine. Okay, I'm making up the last part, but we did end up falling in love and dating for 1.5 years. And to think I owe it all to a head wound. While all my head injuries were pretty much self-inflicted, I can't exactly say the same about my dental problems. You see, that's mostly genetics. In case you need further proof that my mom is a saint, the bum dental genetics are all my dad's fault. The best dental days of my life were when I was 5 years old. Oh boy, I was peaking physically and dentally then. I was well-proportioned, my arms weren't freakishly long, and I had a little meat on my bones. And I had a nice smile. Then my baby teeth fell out, and it's been a struggle ever since. One of my teeth just never bothered to grow back. I mean, what the fuck? And another was just like a little peg tooth, like a pirate's leg next to a bunch of non-pirate normal legs. At one point, I had a retainer with teeth attached to them, which provided plenty of laughs for the kids at school and which also partly explains my status as a late bloomer. However, as girls started to become more important, my laid-back attitude about my pearly whites started to change. I wanted studly and fully formed teeth, not peg leg teeth. After having some minor dental work done and some new teeth inserted to improve my mouth, I eventually headed to college. My teeth were passable until one bright sunny afternoon at Sanford Stadium as the Georgia Bulldogs took on the hated Tennessee Volunteers. I had a bunch of friends in town for the game, and when you know it, the dogs prevailed. After the game, we walked to a house party and I tackled my friend Robbie into some bushes. Standard post-game celebratory move. Robbie retaliated, dove down, and hit my ankle with his hand. My face hit the cement hard, and there went my 2 fake teeth and most of the real ones as well. Even I cringe at this. Luckily, my dentist in college ended up being a cool guy. He went to Phish concerts, so we swapped some fun stories. He definitely wasn't afraid of a good time. I thought I tasted the same night dish from his office in a parking lot at the Fox Theater in Atlanta. I'm just kidding. Somehow, all of my dentists have been super cool people. I might actually harbor some regret that I didn't go down the dental path myself. I too could be a cool dentist. It's a very respectable profession. It's flexible, and it's typically not life or death. It would have saved me a lot of money, that's for sure. But I guess you have to study a decent amount in college to get into dental school, which would have been a challenge for me. Oh well. Perhaps my fondest dental misadventure happened in Sonoma County over the 4th of July in 2009, when I was 29 years old. This was the summer that a handful of my friends decided to meet in Seattle, party a little there, go up to the San Juan Islands and kayak with killer whales, then head down to the Yakima River to camp out for a night. After that, many of the guys went their separate ways, but me and my friend Kirk decided to keep the adventure going. This happens often in Shepland. We rented a car and drove down the Washington and Oregon coast, ending up in San Francisco, where we had a few friends. Those San Francisco friends decided to plan a little trip to wine country for the holiday. Wine country was all new to us, so of course we were excited. Kirk's wife was flying out and a celebration was to be had. The place our friends found was a 10,000-acre vineyard and ranch in the remote winding hills of Sonoma. The closest gas station was 30 minutes away. In addition to our clothes and shoes, we brought along a few pounds of mushrooms with us, and I don't mean portobello or shiitake. We would eat mushrooms mixed in with breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Remember, kids, veggies are healthy. I knew about 6 of the 35 people who were there, but, as you might imagine, if you've dined on this particular fungi, we all became fast friends. I was heavy into Toto at the time, mainly because of their song Rosanna. It's a banger. I first got turned on to it because a friend sent me the music video, and I swear it's one of the funniest and strangest 1980s videos you'll ever see. It's a smorgasbord of mullets. The song is perfect for a post-lunch, pre-dinner mushroom dance session. So that night, fueled by fungi, we decided to create a fake prom and get dressed up. We drew a member of the opposite sex's name out of a hat, and that was your date. We started having fun and dancing. I put on Toto's Rosanna, and the place went wild. All five of us. The other folks were riding bikes down a hill outside. Anyway, a handful of us were jumping around to Rosanna, and then it happened. Again. A wayward knuckle belonging to my friend Bart made square contact with one of my fake teeth, and it flew across the dance floor as the warped, slow-motion sound effect of me yelling no rose above the music. My first thought was, okay, I'm tripping, and I can take this one of two ways. I can be stressed and panic, or I can celebrate the lost tooth. After several seconds of internal mushroom dialogue slash analysis, I decided to go with the latter and celebrate. After all, I had a prom to enjoy. As fate would have it, my prom date's outfit was barefoot and pregnant. She had on a tight dress with a balloon in her stomach and no shoes. I was toothless and wearing a beret. We were a perfect match. So again, what some might deem a tragedy was exactly what the party gods intended. And over my many years, I've learned that you must trust these gods to achieve maximum bliss. When the fun was over, I had to fly from San Francisco to Hilton Head without a tooth, and somehow I got upgraded to first class. We've all walked through an airplane past the first class passengers, stealing glances at them to see who they are. I milked this short stroll through first class for all it was worth, smiling widely with my gap-toothed mouth at everyone I passed, basically proving that class in first class was optional. Writing about my personal injury adventures has caused me to become introspective, even as I cringe through the memories. Thinking back on all of my mishaps has made me think of a cliched inspirational quote. I usually mock these types of quotes, so forgive me for this. What doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Actually, I want to modify that saying, because it often hasn't made me stronger. I tore my MCL in season 6 of Southern Charm by riding a mechanical bull at a bar, an experience that didn't make me stronger physically or emotionally in any way whatsoever. I also separated my shoulder tackling a trash can in Dubai on the 4th of July. That sucked. But guess what all these incidents did for me? They gave the fine people who will one day write my obituary or give me a eulogy more than enough material to play with. It's a virtual treasure trove, so you're welcome, family and friends. I'll try to delay that inevitable fate for as long as I can by toning it down just a little. Not totally, but just a little. My new saying is, what doesn't kill you makes for a great story. And now I'm going to share some of my best advice about accidents and injuries, just in case you see me as an authority on the subject. Personal injury advice. Number 1. Beware of heroics around a pool and or a cliff. Number 2. The best form of humor is wit. Yes, the prom queen might be drawn to the daredevil guy with the skateboard or the BMX bike, but eventually they'll just want someone who makes them laugh by mummifying their skull as a prank. Number 3. I'm not here to say don't climb trees, water ski in an alligator-infested lagoon, or skydive. These are all risky activities that help you learn about yourself, so go ahead. Number 4. The outdoors is a magical and sometimes dangerous place. Get out there and have fun. Break a bone or two, but don't sue me if you do. Number 5. Cause mischief but be contrite afterward. The boys will be boys defense is always there like a shining beacon until you're about 15 or so. Number 6. Take calculated risks, but keep in mind that your demise will break your poor mother's heart, and we can't have that. But if she's not disappointed or slightly terrified by your actions, you haven't done the whole growing up thing right. Sorry, Mom. Number 7. Getting your cast signed as a teen is tantamount to being a rock star on tour, with beautiful girls swarming all around you, begging to make their mark. What I'm saying is take injuries in stride, because you might just get some sympathy from a girl, which has usually worked out pretty well for me over the years. No shame in sympathy loving. Chapter 5, The Asshole Equation. There's a quote from Bill Murray in the great book Live from New York, The Complete Uncensored History of Saturday Night Live, as told by its stars, writers, and guests. A book that I devoured when it was published. After all, these were many of my heroes recounting their time on a show that broke ground, a show that I worshipped. One of my favorites, and let's face it, one of everyone's favorites, is Bill Murray, who just so happens to live in Charleston and who is part owner of our minor league baseball team, the River Dogs. People always ask if I met Bill Murray because of the Charleston connection, and the answer is, yeah, I have, a few times. The first was at a party in Charleston for the finale of Danny McBride's hilarious HBO show Vice Principals. And Bill, if I can call him Bill, was there. I actually walked up to him and talked to him about golf and life in Charleston, and he was very pleasant. But then I screwed up and asked him for a picture, which he politely declined. He's known to be pretty private. He was nice as can be, but I felt like an asshole, and I deserved it. McBride, who I had met a few times before and who told me that he and his wife are big Bravo watchers and fans of Southern Charm, made fun of me. He basically laughed and told me he could have predicted that Murray would say no. It was a disaster, or at least it felt like it at the time. But it's good to be knocked down a peg every now and then. I've also seen Bill at bars in Charleston, and he usually gets mobbed and has to slip out the back. Another time, I was at a restaurant having a burger for lunch, and Bill was there eating in a booth. And some random dude at the bar asked me if that was Bill Murray. So I said yes. Then the dude just slipped into the booth with Bill and asked him for a photo, which made me cringe for many reasons. But mostly because I've actually been that guy. In any case, now I always try to give Bill, or Mr. Murray, space. After so many seasons of Southern Charm, I have a little perspective on what it's like to be in a public place and have people know who you are. And honestly, for me, it's been an overwhelmingly positive experience. People just want a quick picture or they want to buy you a shot or a drink. I chat for a moment and that's it. It can actually be quite lovely, and it's really easy to be nice. It's hard to be a jerk. To be dismissive of people who just want to say hello is just bad karma in my book. Then again, we don't know what it's like for someone of Mr. Murray's stature. I surmise it's a whole different ballgame. Everyone feels connected to you, and I mean everyone. These guys just have generations of fans. It's insane. I've gotten to hang out with a few Saturday Night Live cast members over the past few years, and they are the sharpest, wittiest people. I spent most of the time just trying to mentally keep up with them. Every minute there was a new ridiculous joke being offered up. I loved it. Anyway, I was talking to Will Forte once and asked him whether it was hard for him to deal with fame and being in public, because I was a little curious. This was after Southern Charm's third season, so people were starting to recognize me. Not that I'm comparing myself to an SNL comedian, but I wanted to know. And Will said something like, "Man, for me it's not bad at all. You should see what it's like going somewhere with Will Ferrell." This is all a very long and winding path back to a Bill Murray quote from the SNL book that I love. He said, "When you become famous, you've got like a year or two where you act like a real asshole. You can't help yourself. It happens to everybody. You've got like 2 years to pull it together, or it's permanent." Despite what you might think of me from the show or from people who scream at me via social media, I think of that quote a lot. I fully admit there are certain instances on Southern Charm over the past 7 years that one could point to and say, "But Shep, you were a dick right there. And there. Oh, and there too." And you'd have a good case. I do hope that if you've watched every season, you've seen glimpses of humanity and shreds of kindness in me over the years. Hopefully you see me as someone who likes to have fun and rib friends along the way. What you won't see is that I'm friends with every single cast member behind the scenes. Some more than others, but there is no lingering animosity on my side toward anyone. I've said some hurtful things on camera and off. Nothing that is irreparable, though. And my close friends on and off the show know my true character, which is basically that of one happy guy. How could I not be, honestly? Remember Shepland? Sometimes, though, the pot must be stirred, and sometimes it's a hell of a lot of fun to stir it. For example, when we went to Hilton Head in season 5, and Thomas and Ashley were acting crazy, I walked up to Naomi and Cameron and blurted, "I fucking hate her." Or all the times I get bored at a party and pick a fight with Craig for no reason, just to add some drama. The show has given me lots of laughs and plenty of opportunities. And just like any endeavor that we care about in life, that we want to see do well, you better be passionate about it. The problem is, there are a lot of cooks in the kitchen, and there's no way you're all going to like the souffle that comes out of the oven every episode, every season. But I'd be crazy to tell you I wish I'd never done Southern Charm. I tell people it's a 75% satisfying and fun ride. That's a pretty damn good hit rate in life. And to all the cast members, producers, and executives out there who I've worked with over the years, if I've been cutting, sarcastic, or mean-spirited, I'm truly sorry. It's because I care. Seriously, I do. I want the show to be as authentic, funny, and amazing as possible. And it's been all those things along the way more than it hasn't. There's been too much love and laughter to look at it any other way. So, although I'm nowhere near the stature of Mr. Murray and his castmates on the first few years of SNL from a notoriety standpoint, after a few years of fame, I'm confident that I haven't changed all that much since. Well, let's see, maybe college? If someone truly thinks I'm an asshole, they certainly haven't spent any time with me, and their complaints are just noise from the cheap seats. I admit I haven't really evolved all that much, which may be problematic, but I certainly haven't been on a high horse with people I encounter from day to day. I like interacting with folks. I'm a gregarious and collegial guy. I've got a great family and a group of friends, and I live near the beach in a house of my own. It's like a dream. I have commented many times that I don't suffer fools gladly, and I stand by that. But I love foolishness. I also like to be around thoughtful and engaging people. People who have knowledge of a subject that maybe I don't, or people who are passionate about something, anything. Though I fully admit that sometimes I can be a pseudo-intellectual, at least I can admit it, and at least I'm trying. I love watching documentaries and reading nonfiction. I want to learn as much as I can. But the most important characteristic one can have is a sense of humor about themselves. And usually people who don't are idiots, and I don't suffer them gladly, and I never will. But I'll also try to follow Mr. Murray's advice and not act like an asshole about it. If we're being very honest, being drunk on TV, or being drunk anytime really, can turn even the most mild-mannered chap into a raging asshole from time to time. I would actually categorize myself as a happy drunk, and I take pride in that, like some people take pride in the fact that they're a Nobel laureate or a neurosurgeon. Some people are not happy drunks. Some of my close friends and family are emotional when they drink. The worst kind. Jerry Seinfeld said it best when he said, "I hate being around alcoholics because they're either telling you how much they love you or how much they hate you." That's my nightmare. Being a happy drunk, on the other hand, means you can almost get away with anything. I mean, I've never had my ass kicked outside of a heated Nintendo game in the early 90s, and that says a lot. I've been running my mouth for a long time, but I always find a way to turn it into a funny situation and lighten the moment with some laughter. I always stay away from the dark side, like a devoted Jedi. That said, I've had some asshole moments, big ones. After Southern Charm, Season 6, I was pretty disillusioned, and to be honest, I can be elitist as fuck, but it's not my default setting, and it's not something I'm proud of. But I can get nasty if a certain mood hits. During that time, I had an incident on Instagram where I was walking down the street in New York with friends, laughing and jeering at everything I saw and posting it for the world to see. It rightfully appeared as if I was making fun of a homeless person who had collected a pile of cans. In the video, I said, "nice cans," which is a line from the movie European Vacation, and which is a dumb reference that's only funny if you're hammered and with idiotic friends trying to one-up each other. In reality, it was an unfunny and insensitive joke about boobs. Once I sobered up, I regretted it. I was pissed at myself for even getting into a frame of mind where I wouldn't care who was hurt, all because I wanted to get a laugh. That's not who I am. I'm not the schoolyard bully, but I was so smashed and my lack of awareness that night is astonishing to me. I had a rough season and off season in 2019. I'd love to sit down for supper with anybody who